mean right, if you will, to recover their fair share out of that. They're going to hear that, or the court is, and they're also going to hear from you what it costs you to get that benefit. But that's going to be after the fact. So there's going to be perhaps a deduction from the overall cash that they're going to put into your pocket as a result of this lawsuit.
If I receive a $50,000 award for round figure purposes, and in between that period of time, my health insurance carrier has paid out $10,000 worth of benefits on a package that I purchased. And then, so I get the award of $50,000. You're going to subtract the already received $10,000. Is the company, or in this case, this guy who injures me, going to have to repay that insurance carrier the $10,000 that they paid?
That depends upon the nature of the coverage and whatever rights that they may have, either under that policy or by statute. If there's an obligation to repay by the injured party, comes out of the $50,000, then in that event, the collateral source benefit statute would not be triggered.
Okay, then in this case, and I think this is right, you guys check me, the legislature pays for our health insurance, and I don't think we contribute to that. We might. It's free, something like that.
It's not free. It costs $118 a month for a single person, plus upward.
Okay, let's pretend, then, for purposes of clarity, that the employer pays it as a benefit to the employee. And I get injured, and that insurance carrier, and it's a significant injury, provides me the medical coverage, and perhaps there's number of operations, so it's very expensive. But the award that I receive from whoever benefits me or injures me is equal to the benefits I've received. So in other words, I don't receive any. The person that injured me might get off without paying anything for that injury because my employer provided the health care benefits for me. Is that right?
I have to say that I'm not sure I'm tracking your example. I guess anytime you write statutes, you gotta try to at least my view is you try to design them so that they're result oriented, that it's a performance standards, if you will, rather than telling you exactly how you're going to cross your T's and dot your I's. This statute is set up, and you can use whatever example that you want. But if it's going to avoid somebody getting something twice, and it's going to avoid somebody having to pay twice, it's going to put money back into your pocket. If you had the foresight, you're going to get a credit. It's going to put money into your pocket in the event that you paid for a benefit. You had the foresight to buy a policy, the premium example.
Okay, well, Jeff, I guess I'm having this one problem.
Okay.
If under that example, the person who caused the injury and has a judgment placed against them may not have to pay anything because another insurance carrier or through other benefits has already paid for the, maybe I'm back at work and doing things. So therefore, they're off without having to pay a thing. Shouldn't at least the guys that injured me have to repay that insurance carrier?
Well, I think the answer to that is that if it's a question of your insurance, whose insurance carrier is paying the loss, I think that while this bill does not specifically address that, I think practically speaking, it'll be the insurance carrier of the wrongdoer.
Who pays who there?
Yeah.
Paul's got the insurance policy, the health insurance policy with the state. There's been a decision, there's been some liability. All Paul wants are medical benefits, but they're already paid for. And who pays who? Your insurance company, let's say Blue Cross is covering Paul through the state, would pay Blue Cross. They pay Blue Cross back.
Go ahead.
Yes, Representative Dix, again for the record, Kip Lombard. Most health insurance policies today that we're aware of, and I'm sure you're aware of, have right of subrogation provisions. Also, most health insurance, at least group health insurance policies that I'm aware of, also if you were to try to pile up policies, let's say you had a policy and your wife had a policy, also disallow double payment for certain medical expenses. It's usually only one policy pays that. Most of them have, as I say, the right of reimbursement. So what in effect happens under Representative Phillips' hypothetical is, of course, that the carrier for the negligent party would end up reimbursing Representative Phillips' carrier. The point I think that we must keep in mind, at least in this narrow area of damages, in relating to Representative Phillips' inquiry, Representative Phillips is injured. He has certain medical expenses. Let's say, at least for the purposes of the hypothetical, he doesn't have any other losses. Doesn't have any time loss, no lost wages or anything like that, no pain and suffering, what have you. Just has some medical expenses. Because it is covered for insurance, Representative Phillips suffers no compensatory loss. The idea of the tort system, of course, is to compensate injured parties for their losses.
If Representative Phillips hasn't lost
because of the insurance and because it has been paid, then that's the way this system, the way it works today and the way this would work.
Kip, but the point is, he was talking about disability payments.
Okay.
And maybe I use medical because I know more about medical and disability. The fact of the matter is, I want to make sure that the person who injures me or anybody else pays either me or whoever paid me because I was careful enough or did whatever I had to do in pre-planning. I don't necessarily want to make sure everybody gets paid twice, but I want to make sure that that person who screwed up pays the tab. And I'm not in the sense of punishment, but just pure equity.
Well, Representative Phillips, I think, again, depending on the hypothetical, depending on the rights of subrogation and so forth, that may or may not happen. What happens, as Mr. Johnson pointed out under this bill, of course, is that if you were prudent enough to pay premiums to buy a disability policy, and let me clarify one thing here. Other than for whole life policies, pension benefits and things like that, most insurance that you buy today is on an annual basis. You're only paying an annual premium for coverage for that year, for that premium year, and it ends at the end of that year. So your, quote, investment is from year to year. And the premium, quite frankly, is small, and the amount that you get credit for under this bill, I think in most cases, would be small. But all right, you were prudent enough to cover yourself for disability. All right, insofar as the lost wage or disability portion of your claim may be concerned against a particular defendant, the way this collateral source provision would work is that you would file your suit, you'd make your claims, and it would include, I think undoubtedly, both general as well as special damages. Under special damages, you'd claim your lost wages, that at least is under the law today. If the tort reform package passes, you'll be talking about economic versus non-economic damages. But in any event, the economic and special damages today are pretty much akin, the same. You'll make your claim. If you have already been compensated for that aspect of your damages, but you provided some of the consideration for that compensation, then under the mechanics of the bill, that which you've already been compensated for would be deducted from the ultimate award, but set off against that would be your investment or what you spent to provide for that protection. I almost hear what you're saying in a sense that you want the negligent party, you know, to be stuck, to be responsible, and I think when you look at the whole picture of damages, undoubtedly the individual or that party will be. But the tort system is not just wholly based on a retribution theory, in other words, an idea to get at the person who is negligent. I would venture to say even more so is based on a theory of compensating the injured party for that individual's losses. And if that individual's losses have been already compensated for, then I think the social issue and the social question you have to raise is, should that individual be compensated a second time? If the social decision that you make is, yeah, they ought to be compensated the second time and have the benefit of those disability benefits, I think you simply need to realize that that is an additional cost in the insurance system that we're already undergoing today, and it's a significant cost.
Well, I wasn't advocating double payment. I was, if you want to call it retribution or equity, either one, that's what I was trying to get at.
Okay, well, I think that you have, we try to build into this one anyway, the retribution or equity, from the standpoint that if you yourself provided the consideration for the disability or medical or what have you, that you'll get that back.
Representative Hanlon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I heard both of you, independent of each other, use the phrase, the purpose of the tort system is to compensate for losses. And neither of you included the words based on fault. Would you agree that the last three words probably belong in that sentence somewhere?
Representative Hanlon, I think that, at least from some people's view and maybe ours, the system has gone well beyond based on fault. As you well know, with the expansion of the theories of strict liability, the system compensates sometimes not strictly on a traditional negligence fault-based system, but notwithstanding that, all right, for purposes of argument, we'd say that, yes, the there has to be some type of fault or some type of wrong on the part of the defendant before the defendant is obligated to compensate the plaintiff. No question about that.
And if I may.
Yeah, you each used the sentence and omitted those words, so I suppose, Mr. Johnson, please go ahead.
Well, I omitted it, I guess, intentionally because this bill gets triggered only when there has been a finding of fault, in that the Section 2, evidence of the cost of the benefit shall be presented to the court after return of the verdict or award. So there, that's the condition that this thing comes into effect, that there is fault.
Under the conditions of this bill, is there any requirement or would there ever be a finding of any kind of fault on behalf of the collateral source, whoever it might be?
Well, if your question is,
no,
well,
did you? My question is, would there be fault on the behalf of whoever it was, legal person that actually produced the collateral source benefit?
We're trying to figure, you know, hypothetically whether you could have that situation. Let's say if you had an employer-employee relationship, the employer has a sick leave policy or some type of policy that would pay time loss or time off benefits in the event of injury, and you've got a defendant, third-party defendant, who has some responsibility. If you take the workers' compensation system out of the picture, I suppose you could have a situation where an employer who, in fact, is providing the benefits might have some fault in the situation as well as the third-party defendant. But,
and would, you know, that would that fault then be in any way determinative, the fault of the collateral source?
I don't think that
would that be in any way determinative of any of the monetary benefits or adjustments within this proposed amendment?
I don't think so in this sense, that I don't think that would excuse, you know, one or the other party from ultimately being responsible for the benefit. Somebody is going to be responsible to the injured party for the benefits.
Mr. Chair, if I might follow up, I want to follow up on Representative Phillips' question. Suppose I bought a policy cover health benefits,
That was just clean. It paid, and I bought it for 25 years, paid $118 a month, and then was in this terrible maiming injury event. And I paid $35,400 over the course of that 25 years for the benefit. Under the provision here, it says the court shall determine the cost to plaintiff or plaintiff's estate of obtaining such benefit and shall credit that cost against the judgment. Are you then saying that because I insured this risk over that 25-year period faithfully and incurred costs of $35,400, that the amount the court should credit should be all of the premiums that I paid over this unlikely event of risk?
Representative Hanlon, no. I don't believe the bill would work that way for this reason. Health insurance, by and large...
No, wait a minute. I said I covered this cleanly and paid for it.
No, you said that you covered it cleanly and paid for it over 30 years. You know, I've been paying for my own health insurance for 20, 25 years as well. But if I don't pay next month's premium, I don't have coverage. It's generally health insurance, most health insurance, is on a month-to-month premium basis. And what you pay this month covers you for the next premium period.
So the credit I would get would be for $118 for the 1 month?
It would be determinative of what the policy period is. If you, for instance, have a six-month policy, and that's the term of the policy, then I think you would get the premium for the time period that you're covered.
If I could convince a company to write me a 35-year policy payable at $118 a month, then I would get that?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think you probably would under the terms of the...
But you're talking about an adjustment of probably, in general, a monthly amount.
To be perfectly candid with you, I think in most instances the type of benefit that you're buying is for a short term.
Okay, we've got a few more questions. I'd like to try to wrap up this portion of the discussion by about 7. I know Jeff would like to get home to his family. Representative Dixon, then Representative Phillips.
I'm sure you'd like to do the same.
This is very true.
Health insurance and workers' comp have this subrogation.
I think in almost all instances they do, yes.
Yeah. I must have had some other kind of cash policy in my instance. But I did receive cash from my, and they didn't care.
I think, Representative Dick, sometimes what you can buy are the so-called hospital room benefits policies and things like that. And most of, at least they didn't used to, $10 a day while you're hospitalized or something like that. Yeah. Most of those do not have, as far as I'm aware, do not have subrogation provisions.
Okay. But for the most part, those two are covered. So we're really just talking about disability and pension.
If there is no right of reimbursement. Now, on pension, again, it gets into the difficult question of whether or not, in fact, that is a collateral benefit. We maybe purposefully have skirted even trying to define collateral benefit. Let me give you an example. You'll note in our proposal that life insurance is excluded. Mm-hmm. Quite frankly, both Mr. Johnson and I agree, and a number of folks that I've talked to about, would say that life insurance wouldn't even be considered a collateral benefit in the first place. In other words, if an individual is killed due to the negligent act of somebody else, and the heirs collect on a life insurance policy, that somehow that would be considered a collateral benefit when the heirs turn around and sue on a wrongful death action against the negligent defendant. We don't believe, quite frankly, that would even come under the definition of a collateral benefit. I think when you're talking primarily about collateral benefits, you're talking again about that category, that area of special damages as it is in the law today, or economic damages as it would be under the reforms, where you're seeking return of specific monies like medical benefits paid, lost wages, and things like that, for which you're seeking recovery of those and for which somebody has already provided payment of those specific items.
Okay.
Okay.
Why did we hear the case of Mr. Jones?
It's a frequent occurrence. It's a classic example of where a person can receive double payment.
But we, I thought in health insurance we had subrogation.
Well, again, that is a factual. The Smith versus Jones was an example to show you how something could occur. The difficulty that you have in this area, particularly in drafting this type of a statute, is that the types of insurance that are available and the factual scenarios that arise are so complex and vary so much that you really can't do it. That's why I use that performance standard type of approach.
But for the most part, health insurance is already covered.
For the most part.
We're really just talking, and now disability is something we will talk about for sure. Pensions, let's get down to that. Is it or isn't it a collateral source?
I could foresee the possibility of a pension possibly being a collateral source from the standpoint that if an individual is suing for loss of income or loss of earning capacity up to a certain period of time but was planning on continuing working, I don't know, they might be able to argue that. However, again, pensions, by and large, you know, what is confusing about the picture today is that, I know in our area, typically we see the retired, say, Southern California, Orange County police officer who gets a healthy pension, comes up and works part-time in the valley selling real estate. I think it would be a question of definition, again, under collateral source, what that if that individual became injured and said, hey, I can no longer earn, I can't earn commission selling real estate because I can't sell real estate. Well, there is an identifiable economic loss for that individual. They probably seek that as part of their special damages today or economic damages under the proposed law. Would the pension benefits be offset? Maybe I'm arguing circuitously here, but I suspect that the individual would not be suing for the loss of that because he'd still be getting it. I don't know, Jeff, do you... I'm trying to, you know, think out loud whether or not you have a situation of where somebody might be double recovering on pension, since pension usually by definition is a post-retirement after you've quit working.
I have to agree with Kip on that point. Pensions are kind of a unique creature, and I'm sitting here thinking, well, do we try to work on some statutory language that would deal with pensions, but then that gets us into a very, very, it's a morass. What is a pension and the types of pensions that are available? Well, we'll leave it to the courts to clarify it. We don't want to indent, but then we've got the G.I. Joes. Well, we'll leave it to the legislature and that kind of buck passing. Specifically as far as pensions are concerned, I personally don't think that is a collateral source.
But
because really pension benefits are not necessarily triggered because you get injured and you just decide to quit working and you've paid into it and that kind of thing. That's usually
they are triggered by a date, not by an accident. Right. They'd be triggered by retirement.
What if you were injured at 52 and you can retire at 55 and there was an award on the table? And couldn't you, under those circumstances, go in and say that this person was going to, we'll pay so much up to the age of 55, but after that he's going to receive $2,000 a month from his pension? And that should be considered as a collateral source. In other words, he will no longer work. That he will be compensated economically by his pension, and compensation will take place by, it's really an insurance policy of sorts, the pension plan, and insurance for old age.
Well, in other words, are you the situation you're thinking about is if you're close to retirement, but you get injured and you may have the right of taking early retirement and collecting your pension benefits, but because of the accident, you've decided, well, I'm going to take early retirement rather than it's just time to leave.
Or not be able to take early retirement and have a two-year gap where
you would, as defense counsel, would say, well, we'll cover him for 2 years, but after the third year, he gets his pension, and he gets his pension from the time he's 55 till he dies, and we want that considered in this case for with regard to compensation.
Well, that could happen, but also remember that to the extent that somebody's useful working life is curtailed as a result of the injuries, there would be certainly a right of impaired earning capacity. I mean, we're talking about economic loss that has been bantied around here, but remember that that is also available to the injured party as well.
And it's not like there's... I think I can answer your question looking at the language of the amendments there, and that is this. But the language of subparagraph 1 of the proposed section 13A says that in any action, in the event the injured party has received benefit, that's in the past tense, from collateral source. So if at the time of trial or settlement you're looking prospectively at a situation where the individual is age 52, the individual is entitled to receive a pension at an early pension at 55 if he so elects, I think that would be excluded from this situation by definition because the individual would not have received that collateral benefit yet. Now, that might enter into the negotiations in the settlement, but that's the case today.
But if a person has a pension and is on a pension...
Is on the pension, they've already elected it...
Then it would come into play at that point.
I think it would come into play in terms of what they're claiming for their loss.
Right.
But as I say, I think hypothetically, as we're thinking out loud, the example of the quite typical situation in our area, as I say, where the individual is on pension but is also earning another living, I think that individual would be fully entitled to show the loss, wages, lost salaries from that other occupation, and that the pension would not be subject to the collateral source rule.
So we're back to disability primarily is what we're talking about?
Disability, time loss, similar. Those are the situations where I think it would most often occur.
That's right.
Can you time can... Loss, workers' comp is time loss, and they have subrogation.
They have a right of reimbursement.
Yeah.
Right.
Statutorily.
So I can go down right now and buy 3 or 4 disability policies from the same agent for the same thing. And I can pay on those for 15 years. So essentially what you want us to do is take responsibility to go out and buy disability policies to cover ourselves.
No,
I'm just, but that would be in the best interest of everyone if we were to pass this rule, because if I'm disabled and there's a liability situation that arises out of it, your insurance company is going to pay my insurance company, so that I don't get the money twice. And if I have personal liability policies, that's great, but you're only going to pay one of the insurance companies.
Well,
the insurance companies are going to pay the insurance companies.
There's going to be a segregated interest, but I want to back up to your premise, and that is whether or not, as a result of this particular legislation, it would be people are going to run out and buy multiple disabilities.
Let me withdraw. I'm not suggesting that.
Oh, okay. Because I don't think in terms of what people do to protect themselves in the form by insurance, I don't think it's going to have any effect. And I know we're getting close to 7, and I don't mean to interrupt your line of questioning, but there is a point that I sense you were troubled with that Representative Hamlin dealt with, and that is what I perceived in your reaction, perceived inequity of getting a credit for maybe 1 month's premium on a health insurance policy. I don't think you should be troubled by that for this reason. In the health insurance context, you're going to, again, carry insurance to protect yourself, and you may call upon that insurance for a non-tort reason. So you're gonna keep it. Secondly, that is but one example. The other example in which you may be entitled to much greater benefits is in a loss wage situation where you have to work X number of days to get X number of sick leave benefits, and if you are called upon to pull that out of your bank account of sick leave days, so you're going to get compensated. I mean, there's going to be a credit for that. And so in that situation, it may at first blush bother you, but there are other factual circumstances of which it may cover a much greater period of time.
Representative Phillips.
Well, getting back to one of the issues, I think it would help me greatly to consider this if we included pensions, because under your definitions, they probably, most likely in any way, wouldn't be considered anyway. But you're in Washington County, it takes under 800 days to get to trial. You can go from not receiving benefits to receiving benefits before you ever get a case settled. And see, the judge is the same way in Clackamas County. Wherever it might be, no. 4 months. Well, whatever. Just the point being, if you're not going to consider them anyway, in most cases, then let's make it clear and make everybody comfortable over it. I certainly would feel better about it if that's the case. That's it.
Okay, are there further questions? Counsel?
When you say here, before making the deduction, the court shall determine the cost to the plaintiff or the plaintiff's estate, do you contemplate only out-of-pocket expenses on the part of the plaintiff, or if there's an employer contribution, would you consider that to be a cost to the plaintiff?
We'll only consider that, I think, in terms of the cost to the plaintiff, not the employer.
So it would be only out-of-pocket expenses, a contribution? Okay, thank you.
Yes.
No, when I said put it, excuse me, but a little bit of confusion. When I said put it in, I meant under the exceptions.
I understand.
Okay.
No, I was not confused.
No, okay. I understand.
So you would exempt.